The subject of edema and wetness in general as a term, as opposed to dryness, wetness of the tissue. And I know Dr. Pete's always mentioned that tumours, when they arise, are generally solid, but actually they have a higher than average water content. And so that was part of later on this show's discussion into eye changes, mentioning things like age-related macular degeneration, in particular in glaucoma, also having very high water concentrations, and that being an interesting component, along with estrogen's devastating effects. Can't say enough about estrogen and how bad it is for women. We've done many shows regarding estrogen in the past, and again, it'll bring up the kind of sinister side of estrogen, if you like. And we've mentioned before many times that the only real function for estrogen is for implantation of a fertilized ovum. Outside of that, it wreaks quite a lot of havoc in the female body. It also does nothing very good in a male body. So, but especially with females, the advancing age and estrogen is a very negative and inflammatory molecule. So we'll bring out tonight's subject of estrogen in that context, linking it to HRT and that kind of stuff. The damaging effects of environmental estrogens that are found in such compounds as BPA and other plastics that have a hormone-mimicking effects.
When the organism is exposed at a very early stage, such as during gestation or infancy, the signals for development are changed, so that the especially the reproductive system is changed. But besides changing the individual by giving it false signals, the DNA is altered slightly by attaching methyl groups to it as part of that misguided development. And that means that the ability to express enzymes for the rest of its life will be influenced unless it can somehow remove those methyl groups. But typically they will last for three or four generations, even without further change. So the changes that happen to one individual can be passed on for generations, altering the fertility, for example, until it can tend to cause the species to just disappear.
Okay, so what's your opinion about the amount of pollution that we are as an organism exposed to directly from estrogenic-like substances in the environment?
What we know about certain areas, the Columbia River and the ocean off the mouth of the Columbia, for example, they're seeing lots of fish, simpler water organisms, even mammals that are sexually malformed and developing tumors. Mm. And in Florida, there have been a lot of stories about the swamp animals that are becoming sterile, changing genders and so on. So the news reported about human health, I think, isn't being up to date or honestly reported,
right?
Because what we see in the wild animals, I think it undoubtedly is affecting humans to a great degree too.
Yeah. You think this could be so widespread and so endemic that it's almost impossible for anyone to put a lid on it, and that's why it's not being exposed as much as it should be? Or
Because of the influence of the estrogen industry, there's a terrific reluctance to admit that estrogen has these toxic effects, even though it's been known for 100 years.
Yep.
But it's only in the last 10 or 15 years that people have really been researching in an organized way influences such as these environmental plastic chemicals and so on. And the influence of the estrogen industry is simply going to blame any effects they see on such things as diet, smoking too much, a bad way of living, and so on.
Yeah, rather than the root cause. Well, I hope so. I mean, last month was a testimony, especially for me, having a reasonably close working relationship with you over the last few years doing the show, that you've been consistently mentioning how bad polyunsaturates are, and finally it showed up in the medical literature that indeed what you've been saying is very true. And so I know you've also said that whilst a lie spreads around the world, in a moment truth is still getting her boots on. So hopefully in the not too distant future there'll be printing the same kind of things as you're saying about the estrogens in the environment and what we need to do to protect ourselves from it. Another subject around estrogens, the association of heart failure and cardiac death. What have you found from estrogens' effects on those subjects?
Despite all of the 40 years at least of propaganda trying to sell estrogen to men to prevent heart attacks, for example, they found that they died faster when they took estrogen. But they keep coming back trying to sell estrogen as a heart protective hormone. And the Women's Health Initiative somewhat set that back by showing that the use of estrogen replacement therapy for menopause increased the number of heart attacks as well as cancer and dementia. But despite that, they're still hoping to bring back their sales to the 2002 level where they dropped off so sharply. Just in the last day or two, an article appeared from Yale Medical School doing what they call a meta-analysis, meaning picking out some articles from junky medical magazines and analyzing them for the type of results basically they want. Until the Women's Health Initiative, the medical journals for 20 or 30 years were just swamped with the heart protective benefits and the brain anti-Alzheimer's effect and even the anti-cancer effects of estrogen. And despite the Women's Health Initiative, these people are now looking back at their journals and drawing out of them the kind of information they want. And this study, so-called, published by the Yale people, claims that tens of thousands of women are dying unnecessarily by refusing to take their estrogen treatment for menopause.
No way. Oh, my goodness. When exactly the opposite is true, they've probably got a greater chance of living without it, huh?
Yeah, and hearing it come from Yale, it reminds me of about 40 years ago, there was a daytime television program in which Barbara Seaman debated a Yale professor of medicine. I suspect it's the same one that sponsored this recent study. And she made him look like a complete ignoramus because she knew the facts and he was just quoting the medical doctrine.
Yeah.
I suspect that Yale is now having its revenge because Barbara Seaman is dead.
Okay. Well, let me just remind people who they're listening to here. So you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM. And from 7:30 until the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with any questions either related or unrelated to this month's subject. Our guest speaker is Dr. Raymond Peake. And the number is 923-3911, or if you live outside the area, 1-800-KMUD-RAD. And the lines will be open from 7:30 till 8 o'clock. Okay, so Dr. Pete, again, we'll just carry on a little bit more with the subject of estrogen, because I know that you mentioned that varicose veins were a fairly important outward sign or a visible sign of the lowered ratio of progesterone being the good hormone, the healthy anti-inflammatory hormone. So it's a sign of lowered progesterone to estrogen. What have you to say about that?
Although estrogen is a cell excitant, it, in the process of stimulating one kind of cell activity, tends to make it retain water. The individual cell stays excited too long, and in the process of being excited, the cell admits water, and it has to relax a certain length of time to expel the water.
Right.
And so under the influence of too much unopposed estrogen, cells tend to get more and more waterlogged. And even though they're excited, they progressively lose the ability to contract fully, because in contracting, the protein mechanism has to be interacting with itself rather than pushing against a swollen amount of water.
Right.
And that means that in a muscle such as the wall of a vein, under the influence of high estrogen and low progesterone, testosterone, and so on, the wall of the vein becomes waterlogged and can't contract periodically to maintain its tone. And the same thing happens in nerves, heart muscle, everywhere in the body that estrogen is able to have its influence. And in these estrogen-dominated cells, the ability to contract becomes progressively weaker. Albert St. George demonstrated the effect of estrogen and progesterone on heart muscles over 50 years ago, and showed that under the influence of progesterone, if you stimulate the heart at an increasing frequency, each stroke becomes stronger.
Okay.
So it is an efficient way to respond to frequent stimulation.
Right.
It relaxes in between, gathers its equipment together, and then has a bigger contraction under the influence of progesterone. But if it's influenced or dominated by estrogen, it's unable to accumulate that information that the stimulation is increasing in frequency. So the estrogenized heart will respond to the fast stimulation by just more of the same weak little contractions.
So this
and that's basically how a failing heart behaves.
Right, right. I was just going to ask you that. Okay, so that's a typical picture of a just a gradually aging, failing heart, that it's not allowed to, the excitatory stage is too long, it's not allowed to relax or repolarize and remove the water, and it just gradually gets weaker and more feeble. You mentioned in your response to that last question that progesterone and testosterone, these are two compounds that will oppose the action of estrogen, and presumably then they would be useful for people that had, not just women perhaps, but people that had estrogen dominant type pathologies or you know, conditions.
It's now being recognized that testosterone has an anti-cancer value as well. Just recently, another study came out showing that a testosterone deficiency is a strong predisposer to prostate cancer.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's talk about testosterone a little bit then, as that's a fairly pertinent topic. I know that you've when we've talked in the past about the best way to go about exercising, you've always mentioned non-stressful exercise. So you don't advocate the aerobic type gymnasium workout where you get your heart rate up to 160 and you're breathing rapidly, and that's not what you want. You want weight-bearing exercise that doesn't make you breathless. And I know you've said in the past that that kind of exercise increases your ability to produce muscle, and it's the muscle that's so important in basically helping you to maintain a good stable weight. But that muscle also, through the action of thyroid, enables your body to metabolize things more efficiently, because it's way more of a useful substance in your body than the fat of an unhealthy or unexercised person.
And the muscle also metabolizes the steroid hormones, and with exercise, it can actually secrete testosterone. But in resting, idle, or stressed muscle, without adequate stimulation from good food and thyroid, muscles produce a lot of estrogen. In one study, they were using the blood draining from a monkey's arm to as a control comparison for the blood coming out of the ovary. They found that the monkey's arm was producing as much estrogen as its ovary. And that probably isn't a good representative of the average person, but because the monkey was anesthetized and so on, and under the influence of stress and chemicals. But basically, any stressed tissue is going to tend to produce estrogen. But a well-exercised, strong muscle begins producing testosterone and stops producing estrogen.
Wow. So muscles that in their own right can secrete testosterone?
Yes.
Okay. I think I was always under the impression that in the male, the main site of testosterone production would be the testes. But is there anywhere else in the body that testosterone can be secreted from? Is it?
I think the skin is known to produce testosterone, among other steroid hormones. It's a fairly, it might be the body's biggest endocrine synthetic factory.
Yep. Yeah, we often forget about the skin being the largest organ of the body, but that's true enough. Okay. I have another question for you, and again, it's kind of related to cholesterol. I know that you've mentioned a previous study that positively associated an improved outcome from heart failure in relation to an increased cholesterol level.
That pretty much can be generalized to other muscles. Everyone is hearing the bad news about the anti-cholesterol drugs that cause muscle breakdown.
Right.
Sometimes the muscle breaks down so completely that the proteins leaking from the broken down muscle poison the kidneys and can even kill the person. But that's because they're cholesterol is a stabilizing factor for the skeletal muscles, and if you stop cholesterol synthesis, the muscles are very susceptible to damage. And those same processes are known to occur simultaneously in the heart muscle. The leakage of those proteins that can damage the kidneys, they always assume it is coming from the skeletal muscles, but the heart, under those chemicals, is known to leak the same proteins.
Hmm. Okay, interesting. Okay, I think I got one or two more questions, and then we'll get into the current interest that you have in looking at the similarities or the links between cancers and tissue states, the wetness, especially with eye disease. So that'll be a new and interesting look at the approach to treatment for age-related macular degeneration, for instance. I just had another couple of questions related to cancer. I know you've had, in your previous newsletter, you've mentioned the link between hypoxia, which is a kind of oxygen deficit, and cancer.
The thing that's in the research a lot lately is the hypoxia-inducible factor, which is a protein that shows up. First, they were seeing it wherever they cut off the oxygen supply. But that same protein can really be induced by cutting off the glucose supply, too. So it really should be called the energy deprivation protein. They call it by its name, its initials, HIF, hypoxia-inducible factor.
So it's not it's not so much related to oxygen deprivation as sugar deprivation.
Energy deprivation.
Yeah, okay.
And that has been studied primarily in relation to cancer and finding ways to block that protein production, but it turns out that just getting enough glucose and oxygen delivered to the tissue is a very simple way to inhibit that protein.
So tell me this.
That protein turns on all of the bad processes. Heme oxygenase with carbon monoxide production, nitric oxide synthase, lactic acid production, prostaglandin production causing inflammation, activating aromatase, and so on. Mm-hmm. And then lactic acid in turn activates the HIF, hypoxia factor. So it, once it gets started, the inflammation tends to promote more inflammation and hypoxia.
Right. Now, forgive me for being thoughtless, perhaps, but hypoxia as a state of low oxygen, and being a negative thing, which is what we always normally would associate a low oxygen status with, being dangerous and life-threatening. I know you've always promoted a CO2, a carbon dioxide-rich environment, as being a beneficial cellular matrix, as it were, to have a higher carbon dioxide content. So what would necessarily, I mean, I know you've mentioned that the hypoxia inducible factor you've just talked about is probably more accurately termed a glucose lack, but is there anything really negative about hypoxia?
If you think of the hypoxia as turning on lactic acid, which then turns on all of these other inflammatory signals, and then you see that carbon dioxide turns off the production of lactic acid. Simply the ability to turn off lactic acid production is one of the basic protective features of carbon dioxide.
Yeah. Okay, good. It's the association then between lactic acid and carbon dioxide. That's the important thing. Okay. All right. You're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM. And from now until 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with any questions, either related or unrelated to this month's subject of the heart, hormones and cancer and the eyes. Okay. The number, if you live in the area, is 923-3911. Or if you're outside the area, the 1-800 number is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. And our special guest speaker is Dr. Raymond Peet. Okay, so I think we'll probably get into the next subject, of which I think you're probably going to be writing a newsletter at some point here, maybe, but as yet you haven't. So that, I know when we've spoken, you've mentioned that your research is showing that wetness, as opposed to dryness, the wetness in the eye associated with cataracts is the same kind of wetness that's found in tumors. Is found in the heart during heart failure, and also in the brain during brain disease.
Despite the fact that failing heart becomes hardened, even calcified, and tumors are stiffer than healthy tissue, and even with age, in a very serious dementia, the brain can become sort of rubbery with so many connective tissue cells. Despite the fact that the tissue is becoming firmer, these thick degenerative states actually contain more water, so that if you dry a piece of the organ, it loses much more weight than a healthy organ would.
Okay.
In relation to the given amount of nucleic acid and proteins and so on, these degenerative tissues have a very high percentage of water. But besides the actual percentage of water, the water changes state and becomes relatively more like free bulk water.
Huh.
It can be frozen, where the healthy cell is functioning somewhat as an antifreeze, binding the water so that it isn't as free to move out of the cell or to be frozen or otherwise subject to influence.
Do you think, we do actually have a couple of callers on the line, but do you, just quickly to rephrase what you said, are you saying that the water found in these tissues during these type of pathologies is not electrically the same as regular water?
Well, if you freeze, say you have a lens that has cataracts in it,
mm-hmm.
and has a much higher percentage of water per protein molecule.
Yeah.
And if you freeze that, it'll crystallize easier than a healthy lens. And this can be studied in an MRI machine because you can very clearly see the difference between the water that's bound firmly to the cell in the way it should be, or the water that's just sitting there as excess useless water, huh. plugging up the cell function.
Huh. Interesting. All right. Well, let's not keep these callers. I think we've got three callers on the line now. So let's take the first caller.
We had another person that didn't want to wait, but she wanted to know if black cohosh was effective for menopause.
Okay. So bit of a convoluted question, because black cohosh is typically used in the literature for menopause, decreasing night sweats. But I think there is also a lot of research coming out of Europe which actually prevents the use of black cohosh, excuse me, as a kind of more of a kind of estrogen stimulant. So I've always kind of viewed black cohosh with a little bit of caution. It's not something that I would say straight away would be useful, but there are other ways to lower your estrogen state, because the whole point of the black cohosh was that it was more of an estrogen replacement. So
I've heard some ideas that it was an anti-prolactin factor. I don't know what the current state of that idea is.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about that either, Dr. Pete. And what did you say, Sue?
She wanted to know what the best herb would be for menopause, or herbs.
Well, really, it's probably as much about your excess estrogen as anything else. I know, Dr. Pete, in terms of menopause, you would probably suggest that excess estrogen is one of the main causes, and to bring that down into line with the anti-estrogen hormone, pregnenolone or progesterone, would probably be the most efficient way of doing it.
And usually thyroid.
Right.
The cholesterol tends to rise at menopause, and if thyroid is adequate, that will keep turning the cholesterol into more of the pregnenolone and progesterone to protect against estrogen.
Right. Good. Okay, so there's another caller on the line. So let's take this next caller. You're on the air.
Hello, this is David. You know, and I know this is kind of a deep subject, and I've heard you ask questions before about water, Andrew, and I've read different things that Dr. Pete has written about, like polywater and different types of more structured water. And I'm just curious, you asked a question just a minute ago, and I don't know if I understood the answer, but when we have these tissues that are experiencing edema and we have, you know, what we're calling H2O, is that water considered to not be structured at its optimum? And in line with that, kind of a similar question is, it seems like I've heard that, I think I've heard this from Dr. Pete and these different discussions, that do we produce our own water at times, and is that a more structured water? And then the other question is, like, when we drink orange juice or we drink milk and say we're drinking raw milk versus pasteurized milk, is the water content within those foods, is that considered a very optimum structured water?
Okay, Dr. Pete, did you hear those questions clearly? Or?
My article on the poly water question talks about some of the ranges of influence, how far a certain surface can influence a structure, such as in clay. The water in ordinary clay is structured differently from bulk water. But there's also a question of how long the influence of that surface can last. Gerald Pollack at the University of Washington has, there are some videos on the internet that you can see his demonstrations of some of the odd behavior of water, even in a fairly bulk situations. But ordinarily, it doesn't make any difference whether you drink water that has been boiled recently or frozen recently. It's mostly a matter of degassing that makes it behave differently according to its recent history. It's safe to drink tea or coffee water that's been boiled. But what matters is the state of the water inside the cell, and that's governed by the energy of the metabolism and the ratio of things like carbon dioxide to lactic acid. In the lens, the proteins in other hard tissues, collagen is the main protein that gives it stiffness, but in the lens, the main protein is called crystalline, and it happens that crystalline is very well ordered with reference both to the structure of water and to the wavelength of visible light, so that the water surrounding these proteins in the lens is so well ordered that it doesn't interfere with or reflect or absorb the light passing through it. So it's an essential protein for maintaining the transparency of the lens. And this protein, if you compare it to collagen or albumin or other common proteins, the protein can bind very firmly much more water, about twice as much water as other proteins, and hold it under its influence. Really, the water of the lens and the protein is in a tight system in a normal state, but when the energy processes fail and you absorb influences such as estrogen, polyunsaturated fats, lactic acid, various toxins, then the energy is unable to repair the system, and the water gets out of control of these proteins and starts becoming ordinary bulk water that interferes with the passage of light and lets junk accumulate, such as broken down fragments of polyunsaturated fats, acrolein, for example, breaking down from the N-3 proteins is a major factor in a cataract formation.
Okay. I want to make sure that fairly quickly, because we do have a couple more callers, but that last caller also asked if we produce our own water, and is the water in milk and OJ an optimum type of water?
The water that has been filtered through an orange tree or a cow, it's at least very purified compared to water you get out of the city plumbing.
Because I know you're not very keen on water, just per se drinking water. You'd much rather people drink something that has nutritional value.
Yeah, and we do make quite a bit of water metabolically when we eat carbohydrate. In particular, we turn some of the oxygen that we are using to produce energy, some of that becomes water, mm-hmm. and the metabolic water is just intermixing with the water that we get from the food itself. But the nature of the oxygens contained in carbohydrates can influence the metabolism of the cell. The hydrogens, as well as the oxygen, are a mixture of isotopes of different weight in everything that we eat or consist of. We have a mixture of these different weight isotopes, and heavy water, deuterium oxide, it slows down our metabolism. So there's a slight difference in the water that we get from tropical sugar versus beet sugar that's grown up in a high altitude because of the, the rainfall is separating the heavy water from the light water.
Interesting.
So that there is a slight difference in the quality of the water depending on where the fruit grows.
Yeah. Far out.
Hey, Andrew, and I know I'm going to say this real quick. I'm sorry, but I just want to make sure I understand one thing. So in a way, the water, like you're talking about in the lens of the eye, it's structured so that it's almost like crystalline and that it actually structures the different materials that it's intermingling with?
Well, the protein structures the water, and then the water admits things selectively.
Okay. Well, hey, thank you for that. That's really interesting. But thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your call. Okay, we have two more callers, so let's take the next caller. You're on the air? Where are you calling from?
Oh, hey, I'm calling from Laytonville down here.
Okay.
And I'll be real quick. I know you got another call. And great show. Very, very interesting here.
Thank you.
I hate to backtrack here, but I take about 100 milligrams of metoprolol.
Okay.
You know, it's a cholesterol thing. I've been taking it every day for like 5 years. I also take isosorbide. It's a time-release nitroglycerin, you know, for my heart.
Right. You have angina?
I've had like 7 heart attacks in the last 9 years. I'll take my answer off the air, but with this much metoprolol, is this something I should be concerned about? Should I, you know, like talk to my doc about it?
Okay. Dr. P, what do you think about that?
I don't know that drug. Do you know what class it is?
I don't either. One moment. I don't know if the call is still there or not.
Hello.
Hi. Did you ask hear Dr. Pete? He was asking if you knew what class of drug metoprolol was in.
I take it for my cholesterol. That's all I know.
Right. Yeah. I'm not too sure.
The only safe way I know to lower cholesterol chronically is by increasing thyroid function. In 1936 or 7, people demonstrated that if you remove a person's thyroid gland, their cholesterol level goes up as a mirror image of their oxygen consumption going down. And when you give them a thyroid supplement, the cholesterol will fall as the oxygen consumption increases. That's a very simple mechanism that doctors prefer to prescribe drugs with the toxic side effects, and just lowering the cholesterol, even if the drug didn't have other side effects, the cholesterol is normally destined to turn into DHEA progesterone, testosterone, and so on. And so if you push down the availability of cholesterol by any mechanism, you're going to tend to deprive the body of those steroids that it should be forming.
All right. Hey, you guys are great, man. Thanks for all the information.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Okay, so were there any more callers on the air, Sue? Yeah, one more. Okay, so let's take this next caller. You're on the air? Oh, okay, they've gone. Okay, they've hung up. Okay, well, the number here, if you live in the area, is 923-3911. Or if you live outside the area, the number's 1-800-KMUD-RAD. And the lines are open till 8 o'clock. So, guest speaker, Dr. Raymond Pete, we're covering his latest work on the similarities between the component or structural components of cataracts, the conditions like macular degeneration, tumors, and heart failure in terms of the heart muscle. So I just wanted to ask you this next...
We had two very shy callers that didn't want to go on the air. Okay. And one question is regarding the thyroid supplements, does it matter if it's T or T3? That's one question. And then I'll ask the other one.
Okay. All right. Well, there's two. There's T4 and T3. So it would very much matter depending on what their situation was, which one they may or may not be short of. So it's Dr. P, how would you best answer this? Because this is your subject.
Well, if the study that led to the substitution of thyroxine or T4 or the natural combination T3 and T4 was a test on male medical students, average age in the early 20s,
okay.
And being male, they didn't have the problems that typically females have about 5 or 10 times the incidence of thyroid problems. So they tested thyroxine on a population that was extremely inappropriate for testing a thyroid product, and they said it works just like natural thyroid. And since it was a commercial proprietary material, they preferred it to the natural product. But after about 10 or 15 years, the actual active hormone, T3, was identified and studied, and it was found that this is what women lack typically, causing them to have 5 or 10 times the thyroid problems that men do, because estrogen interferes with the gland's secretion of both T4 and T3, but it especially interferes with the liver's ability to convert thyroxine to the active hormone T3.
Right.
So many women actually get worse symptoms when they take thyroxine because it suppresses the little bit of T3 that their thyroid gland is producing, yet doesn't add to the amount of T3 that should be produced by the liver.
Okay, excellent. And there's another reason why the excess estrogen found in postmenopausal women or even menstruating women works against them, or works against their thyroid?
I didn't hear that.
Okay. I just said that that's the main reason why menstruating or postmenopausal women are at more risk in terms of low thyroid function.
Some of the typically female problems such as endometriosis are just amazingly responsive to the proper thyroid supplementation.
Yeah.
Because once the thyroid goes down, then estrogen goes up.
Right.
And since the estrogen blocks thyroid action, it becomes a vicious circle.
Yeah, got it. Okay, well, there is another caller on the air, so let's see if...
Well, no, it's the caller who didn't want to go on the air, but they wanted to know what the effects of cannabinoids are on cancer.
Dr. Pete.
Oh, on cancer, I think people are still exploring that. There are some suspicions that it might actually slow cancer growth. Others worry that it might make it worse, but mostly it's used to prevent the stress symptoms,
right.
and for that it's effective.
So what do you just talking about that a little bit more, in terms of, as much as anything else, helping me understand more about it, because again, I think I'm probably on the fence in terms of not knowing enough one way or the other, but in terms of the plant and its relationship to hops, both in the Cannabaceae, hops express a lot of pro-estrogenic compounds, which is why the hop pickers during hop picking in August in England would lose their periods. Such was its powerful effects on the hormone system. Do you look at those compounds as being pro-estrogenic? And if you do,
definitely. Hops is a very powerful estrogen.
Right. How is there any similarity given that the plant's in the same family?
I'm sure there's a lot of overlap. Almost every plant has some estrogenic or anti-estrogenic material, but mostly they're estrogenic because it's a defensive material that, for example, acts like birth control pills for predators. known effects of heavy marijuana smoking are definitely estrogenic, but some of that could just be that any kind of smoke is estrogenic.
Right. Right. And is there any parallel? I know carbon monoxide is present in abundant quantities when you smoke. Is there any way, and I've seen blood work from clients who are smokers, they always seem to have a pretty high CO2, which you would say is a good thing. Is there a beneficial, I'm not saying smoking's good and we should all start smoking, but is there anything more simplistic, or is there something, you know, more more dangerous at work than just getting a little bit of extra CO2 in your system?
Carbon monoxide can accumulate and have some chronic harmful effects, such as on the liver function. But I think the real danger of smoke is the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are inflammatory and estrogenic and carcinogenic. Just anything you burn is going to produce some of those. And then any smoke of a plant material is going to produce some dioxin-type material.
Right. Okay. I certainly do have more I want to ask you about in terms of your work looking at tissues and wetness and tumors. But for fear of running over the show, I don't want to ask any more callers on the air. I think we do have a couple waiting. But I think we're going to carry this one on next month. I think there's enough interest in it, certainly, to bring out more callers. So, Dr. P, I think it'll give me an opportunity to let people know more about you, and I'll thank you very much for joining us.
Okay. Hope you get a better line.
I do, too. I'm sorry for the listeners who perhaps found a little difficulty in hearing Dr. P, and I'm sorry, Dr. Pete, that you've had difficulty hearing as well. Okay, so just to wrap up the show, the next few minutes that we have, Dr. Raymond Pete has a website, and his address is www.raypeat.com. He has something in excess of 50 or more scientific journal articles that are fully referenced scientifically, so it's not just hearsay. He's been... why'd you call it? He's been crying out loud from a distance for quite some time now. I'm glad that people are hearing what he has to say, and I'm glad that he's being vindicated by current scientific literature being in accord with what he's been mentioning for 20 or 30 more years. So his website there, raypeat.com, is an excellent source of information. Would encourage you very much to go check it out. For those people that have tuned into this show, thanks so much for calling. It's always very helpful that you call in, and that we know that the people out there that are listening and want to know more. I think it's always good to have that kind of doubtful mind that wants to seek out more information and not just be fed what it is that comes through the TV and in, you know, from adverts and commercial newspapers, etc. So our toll-free number is 1-888-WBM-HERB. Sarah or I can be reached Monday through Friday, or maybe Sarah can't at this point in time, folks. I guess she has a baby. I've got to start thinking that she's right there right now. But okay, but I can be reached Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, consultations or whatever, at the end of the show. And if you have other questions relating to this month's show, that would be fine too. Okay, so thanks so much for joining us, and for those people that have ears, let them hear.